You may recognize Wag the Dog, the movie's theme by Mark Knopfler, which seems like appropriate music for today's show. And what do we got? Gladio B. London with US-UK backing of Al-Qaeda in Syria, the same trap MI6 and CIA Pirates of the Thames and Potomac set up in Afghanistan, responding to 1973 Arab oil embargo with acid-throwing monsters forcing women into veils, the slave-raping moral equivalent of our racist founding fathers, provoked intervention by abolitionist Russians, while, like bin Laden under Pakistan's ISI nose, the, quote, mastermind, unquote, of a Paris attack fled back to NATO headquarters, which orchestrated the Bologna train station bombing and virtually all the left-wing terrorism that ravaged Cold War-era Europe and is now running Gladio B. It's the same terrorism committed by the same people. The only difference is that they're falsely blaming it on Muslims rather than leftists, and Trump's Muslim ban is all of a piece of this. London, like Brussels, is a natural place for the Gladio false flag. Now, we're going to get into Intel Chief and Frankenstein Mayor Difi's little history. Remember, she was grafted onto Moscone's body politic. Was said to be mad at the backstabbing spooks for snooping on her after she announced the apps of the conspiracy on their behalf as the bodies hit the ground in San Francisco and Jonestown, Guyana. So, that was very spooky business down in Guyana. Maybe we'll get into there a little bit. As they are dragging us to hell with the Takfiri Crusader Army created for Iraq, Libya, Syria, our post-9/11-01 hit list, and willful blindness. Makes me shudder thinking about this morning's radio 10 points down the dial. There was, not Paul, the other, yeah, his thing is, the journalist for whom the Philip is named, which is bending over backwards to stick your head where the sun don't shine, thanked him for calling it a civil war in Syria when we're sending 20,000 headmen there. Remember, after the stand down, you know, you have a line of Toyota, unarmored Toyotas, you know, straight from special ops retrofitting in Texas to the Salafist Principality, 2012. Michael Flynn put it on the paper. Hey, we're back. The West is back in these peeps. Now, every time you hear Russia, 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 bad Trump, Putin, Russia, then what they're doing, they're swagging the dog. They're driving a division in the peace process because that's how we dodged those Clinton death squad bullets, is diving into this successful, you know? And so they're going to deny us even that by saying, Russia, Russia, bad, bad. Trump and Russia in bed together. So, see, they're wagging the dog, just like, you know, talking about Monica but not Mina. They're wagging the dog. It's not going to get back to them, you know, like it would if they actually went after the Hassanpuss paper trail, because that 15-year-old shot him down and he sang like a canary. He pointed to Luis Posada Carriles and Rodriguez, you know, Felix, the rat, the CIA rat. So that's who Millian Rodriguez goes, or no, he hits Millian Rodriguez, the Medellin, you know, wanderer, who Bush made a big deal, the elder Poppy Bush, busting in Florida, which really pissed him off, having his face flashed all around. So he tells Congress, well, hey, you know, why do you think Zapata's got their office in Medellin and, you know, a platform right off of Cuban shore? That's because it's a front for Cloak and Dagger. Now, Cloak and Dagger, what were we going to talk about here? Oh, hold it, Mark.
Steve Bannon is a total scumbag. I mean, you can go from everything from his investment from IGE, which was making money for known pedophiles, to his serial wife abuse
And okay, so the known pedophiles, we already have the 15-year-old, okay, no, no, the 15-year-old, the predator, no, right, he's not, a, he's, Humadine's, okay, Wiener is Huma Abedin's ex, and the FBI are looking the other way before everybody in the media says, oh, look, look, he's attacking Hillary by not talking about Trump's blah, blah, blah. But John Wiener was getting this green light to do the pedophile thing, sexting a 15-year-old with no warrants from the FBI. And so Huma Abedin is the chief of staff of Hillary, and all of these Podesta emails are between her and John Podesta, and they include the fact that $20 million from this Saudi prince is coming from the guy arming these, what shall we call them, the Tech Fury Crusader Army created for Iraq, Libya, Syria, our post 9/11/01 hit list, who we had, backed against the USSR, and then the war on terror, so-called, was a 180 in the Contra War, where we attacked our terrorists after this Northwoods op, you know, the air defense stand-down the Pentagon did with its drones and controlled demolitions. And then there was the redirection, which is another 180, taking us back to the original Contra War direction without ever suspending our war on terror. So you're doing the same thing at the same time. You know, so you got that. Yeah, and Al-Qaeda is on the side of the Saudis in Yemen. And so at the same time, the Pentagon is bombing one thing, the other is drone bombing the other, so. Let me get out of this page. Oh yeah, so the Crusader Army, the Tech Fury Crusader Army that Michael Flynn put paper trail to when he said in 2012 DIA report the West supports the Salafist Principality. And it's in Iraq and Libya and Syria, our post 9/11 hit list countries. And the media's willful blindness shilling for the latest CIA rape camp theocratic utopia, quote unquote. But we should mention that the overlooking of oversight about this intelligence business, someone surely laughing all the way to the bank, maybe the 19,000 who drone bomber and his Swiss bank account holder / UBS lawyer Eric drove getaway car for jailing Bradley Birkenfeld and Scott Bennett after funding the 40,000 headmen with Poppy Bush's Afghan opium war narco dollars. Now, maybe I sound a little scatterbrained and everything, but oh no, you got rid of the, maybe it's here, the buzzsaw thing. Anyway, here, this is the London flash flag. I'll try to re-up the, Scott Bennett, Oliver Stone one that I don't think we got through.
This week, where to start? Well, where else to start? Another.
What? Oh, Mike.
Easy thing to see that there's something really about site intelligence. Wouldn't lie.
And if they miss any dazed, deranged individual, presumably of Islamic origin, supposedly ran over a week and then some, and there was a lot of crazy stuff happening this week. Where to start? Well, where else to start? Another London false flag. Tony, when you got the news that a crazed, deranged individual, presumably of Islamic origin, supposedly ran over a couple of people near Parliament under Big Ben in London, did you immediately feel suspicious?
Oh, no. I just believe CNN, and they wouldn't lie to us, of course. Mainstream media are pretty reliable, and I just assume we can read Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and they'll pretty much tell the truth. They wouldn't lie.
And if they miss anything, of course, you can always tune in to False Flag Weekly News and just make sure that they crossed all their T's and dotted all their I's. Well, geez, you know, Tony, this thing like stinks to high heaven just from the get-go. It's on March 22nd. This is the end of the three-day satanic feast of Pelusia. If you look at the websites for survivors of satanic ritual abuse, they have an especially hard time on dates like this. And last year on the 22nd of March, we had the Belgian airport attack, now proven to be a false flag. I've gone into all the details on that with Oli Damagard on my radio show. And then exactly 1 year later, this happens. Right after massive terror drills on the River Thames, as usual, the alleged perp, security services were all over him, and so on and so forth. And then it's right in the middle of this craziness happening over with Syria and Israel and Russia. So, I don't know. Give us a brief breakdown of your interpretation.
Well, unlike the Brussels event a year ago, this seems to be real. Brussels event was just crisis actors. This seems to be actual dead people. I keep hearing about this person with a kippah. I'm not really sure what a kippah is. I assume
it's that little beanie. It's a Jewish beanie as opposed to a Catholic Pope's beanie.
You know, taking a selfie with a selfie stick, and that seems to be featured again and again. I keep seeing the analysis that this has every mark of an Israeli-backed job. It sort of has the various characteristics and attributes. What do you think, Kevin? You've already written about it. You seem to be on the cutting edge when these events come up. You're the go-to guy. You tell me about it.
Well, as our next slide shows, when Rita Katz and the Site Intelligence Group, which is a spinoff from the Israeli Mossad, take credit for something like this, I'm inclined to believe them. How about you?
Yeah, well, Site Intelligence, I think, is a very rich window into this Islamophobia industry and the false flag terrorism business underneath it. Has very close ties with the New York Times. I was interested to see, with a little bit of research, it led back to the Rand Corporation, a professor type called Bruce Hoffman, who teaches in the Washington area. It's very easy to see through Site Intelligence, which seems to have the inside track, seems to have the franchise on the latest beheading videos, and seems to be in touch with, like, Michael Slay, you know, who sometimes is a Nazi writer and sometimes is an Islamic jihadist writer and works closely with Rita Katz. It seems a very easy thing to see that there's something really about Site Intelligence that is very different than how it presents itself.
Absolutely. I mean, and just ask yourself, why would real radical Muslims choose an Israeli Mossad spinoff like Site as their PR agency? I mean, it's ridiculous and absurd just from the get-go. But here we have Site claiming credit. We have the guy with the kippah, the little Jewish beanie, taking selfies, which reminds us of the dancing Israelis taking selfies in front of the burning, then exploding Twin Towers. It reminds us of Richard Guchar, the Israeli Mossad operative, married to Einat Wolf, one of Israel's top black operators, showing up to take the pictures, not selfies, but the propaganda pictures at the Nice alleged truck attack. He gets the truck before it even starts out. And then he's there 1 week later for the beginning of the shopping mall shooting in Munich, Germany. Quite a coincidence there. So these Israelis are constantly, I could go on like that for hours. These Israelis are constantly showing up and placing themselves at the scene of the crime and being involved in here trying to accredit it to ISIS. So yeah, I agree with you that this looks like an Israeli job. And I think the Veterans Today analysis on this was pretty good, which is that it looks like Bibi Netanyahu is having problems in Israel where they may be busting him for some corruption charges and taking him down. And so he's getting out of control, spreading all kinds of crazy stories about airstrikes, which we'll get into later, and very likely being involved in this London false flag, just like he was involved in the earlier London false flag in 2005.
Yes. Site Intelligence, you came up with a phrase, the PR agency, the Israeli-backed PR agency for the Islamic State, Daesh, Al-Qaeda, whatever label you want to put on this same group that keep being deployed and mobilized in psychological operations to justify warfare abroad on Islamic majority countries and in increasing surveillance at home.
It's always Site that gets the ISIS statements. The you know, everything goes through Site. It's, you know, it's just so transparent, but our media will not tear off that veil and show us what's really crawling around underneath it. Well, we have another.
That would take insight.
yeah, and analysis and hard work and courage and all those things. Well, Tony, we had a pretty interesting time in Paris a while back, I guess a little over a year ago. It seems like ages ago. And, you know, we went through that airport. I went through De Gaulle Airport several times in Paris on our way to the False Flag Islamophobia Conference. Well, the Paris Orly Airport had an incident this week. I love the headline. Armed assailant shouted, "I am here to die for Allah," and just got himself shot down. Turns out it was a petty criminal, and as usual, he was on the radar of all of the secret services.
Yes, and Allah seems to be doing the work in the airports of Europe.
Right, yeah. These people are really, you know, dying for Islamophobia. They're dying for public relations stunts to make you imagine that there's some kind of Islamic terrorist threat out there. And in fact, of course, we know who's really behind that. Well, ISIS, or the Israeli Secret Intelligence Service, is calling for the assassination of various Muslims around the world. Of course, ISIS mainly targets Muslims. 95% plus of all ISIS's victims are Muslims. And now they're trying to kill Muslims here in America. Tony, why do you think it is that a supposed radical Muslim group fighting for Islam is doing nothing but slaughtering, attacking Muslims, causing chaos in the Muslim community, creating PR nightmares for Muslims, and generally serving the enemies of Islam?
Yes, this word takfiri, which may not be a household term for everybody, this takfiri concept of Islamic people hating other Islamic people or turning on other Islamic people. Of course, this goes back to Wahhabism, to Saudi Arabia. Who's behind Saudi Arabia? How is Saudi Arabia? How is the royal family set up there? This goes back to, you know, Israel. This goes back to the American Empire emerging out of World War II. So why is it that this Saudi Arabia has put so much effort into turning those who listen to its particular extremist brand of theological doctrine? Why is Saudi Arabia working to turn Muslims against other Muslims? And who's behind Saudi Arabia?
Well, the Saudi rulers know that they won't be in power unless they have the support of these global imperial and Zionist forces. So they do pretty much what they're told for the most part. Classic case of a puppet state. You know, we have a lot of countries like that that are heavily influenced or dominated or ruled by the empire, outside forces.
And these proxy armies like Islamic State or Al-Qaeda, they're run by what is essentially a proxy army. Saudi Arabia, in its essence, is like
documents,
a proxy army.
24,000 bank accounts, WikiLeaks.
Absolutely.
Tables, Department of Justice letters that indicate, you know, a false case against him, a Lenikoff, all these big clients, big Hollywood clients, and big, you know, political clients. Senator Phil Graham, John Boehner, all these guys with Swiss bank accounts, who I don't have a problem naming names, and I intend to appear before a congressional committee and expand that name list. But I dug all that stuff out with Birkenfeld, and I said, "Brad, you won't believe this, but I was looking for you when I was in the military down at U.S. Central Command. How come I never heard of you?" And he said, "Scott, no one in a military uniform or in the intelligence community ever sat down and debriefed me. I tried to get out to Carl Levin. Barack Obama was on the Carl Levin committee at the time, and I tried to get all this material out, but I was shut down by Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer. They wouldn't let me talk to anybody. They wouldn't let me talk to the military. They wouldn't let me talk to DIA or CIA." Now, of course, DIA and CIA knew perfectly well that Birkenfeld existed, but officially, he wasn't given that ability to talk and expose because, you know, he would have been exonerated for a lot of things. And that led...
Well, that led so the $100 million payoff on September 12, 2012, on the day that Ambassador Chris Stevens got it for forgetting that Libyans are Libyans. That was to not talk, even though he did. He said UBS kicked down $900,000 and something to the Clinton Foundation because the, you know, I don't know, less than $100,000, less than six-figure donation up to that point wasn't enough to quell the investigation, and the investigation was stopped. The Bradley Birkenfeld, the investigation into Bradley Birkenfeld's 19,000 UBS Tech Fury accounts.
Led me to believe that there was a major cover-up, and then we, Brad always said, Lanny Brewer and Eric Holder worked for Covington and Burling. That was the firm that represented Union Bank of Switzerland. That's why they prosecuted him. That's why they gave them a non-prosecution agreement to UBS. That's why they only fined them 2% of their profit over a year, which came to like, if you're a taxpayer making $50,000, your fine was like 25 or 50 bucks or whatever, $1,000. I can't remember the calculation we did. But it was obscene. So Brad and I put all this together. We funneled a letter to U.S. Central Command James Mattis. And Brad said, I'm the UBS whistleblower. All this material that you need to fight the war on terror and combat terrorist financing, I have. Please debrief me immediately. And I want to bring in Scott Bennett, who's a terrorist finance analyst previously with Booz Allen Hamilton, who can confirm a lot of my material is genuine and that is essential to the war mission. And we sent that out August 1st, 2012. On September 11th, 2012, a little over a month, Brad was paid $104 million. And that September 11th, 2012 is the same day as Benghazi.
Right.
A lot of CIA speculators have said they did that intentionally because the Benghazi Birkenfeld shell game was to divert attention away from that big payment and cause people to dig up what was going on. And Jesselyn Raddick represented Brad Birkenfeld. She did his wiki page and PR, according to Brad. And now she also represents Edward Snowden. So Brad had said to me, get in contact with Jesselyn Raddick. Get in contact with Cohn and Colapinto, my attorneys, and provide them with what you can provide that substantiates my Swiss bank terrorist finance connection.
Right.
And I did that. And no one, not any of those lawyers, ever responded to me and refused to debrief me. And what I think was happening was they just wanted him paid. They just wanted to collect the money. And they didn't care about the military dimensions, the war dimensions, the soldiers that are killed, these Swiss banks that have been continuing since 2012, actually before, 24,000 of them, and some of which, I mean, are billions and billions of dollars that have gone to a lot of the bad guys you see in ISIS, black operations there. Now, Jesselyn Raddick also works for or represents Edward Snowden. So here you've got Jesselyn Raddick representing Snowden and Brad Birkenfeld and me right in the middle. Connected to Snowden through Booz Allen Hamilton and the military. Snowden went into special forces, broke his legs in a training jump. Brad Birkenfeld connected to me through terrorist financing work and prison. And just combining it all and then bringing in Julian Assange because his WikiLeaks cables were all exposures of the State Department Counterterrorism Office where I worked. The State Department Counterterrorism Office focusing on Birkenfeld to cover him up, to silence him, to gain political advantage with the Swiss and send Chinese Uyghurs from Guantanamo over there and get all sorts of benefits and treaties and all that. So the skullduggery and the corruption is all there. It just has never been exposed and put on the table, but it soon will be.
Well, let's start doing that. Basically, we know, obviously, the Swiss bank accounts are secretive, right? And so the idea is always, well, you know, we can't trace and know where, you know, where the money ultimately comes from. In your analysis, talking to Birkenfeld, to your experience before that, who are the major financiers of the modern jihad that we're looking at?
as to why the other people might not have picked it up and talked about it is because they're not fearless.
You say the hill's too steep to climb.
Before we get to the merciless part, let's stick with the smiling part, because I ain't going to get into this without invoking some pink. Now, what was it? Never mind about the input jack on the Audacity recording, but the other window, where are you hiding? Oh. It's not pink, it's history. Yeah, it's because, jump. There was the thing about the, the local, too local to worry. I was gonna go 13 minutes and 38 seconds into Africa Today from yesterday.
Influence on the pants, and they had influence on those other movements as well.
You mentioned in there, I think there was a book, if I'm not mistaken, by Kamosi Woodward, I believe, who looked at communities and how they fit into that era of the 1960s. And it was great information that you were talking about, how people in Oakland and the West Coast responded to what was happening in Birmingham, or what was happening in Selma, or what was happening with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. What's your thoughts on that? You tell that story through the eyes, I think, of someone named Mark Comfort. Enlighten us a bit on that, Robin.
Yes, Mark Comfort I found to be just a fascinating example of how a local activist moved around. He literally moved through so many different political moments, unifying and providing like this common thread that kind of, I think, through which you can see the foundations of the Panthers. So he was an interesting person. His wife was connected to the Communist Party. She was a red diaper baby. He was someone who'd been very influenced by the civil rights movement in the South. He traveled to the South several times, connecting himself to activists in Lowndes County, Alabama, in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He's one of the first people to bring the image of the Black Panther in the Bay Area and to wear a beret. I mean, in a lot of ways, he was one of the first people to speak out against the Vietnam War. He had a 45 that he would sell called Damn Vietnam. He spoke out against the censorship of the local white newspaper, the Oakland Tribune. So in a lot of ways, he kind of represents the very multi-issue milieu that the Panthers kind of grew out of. It's important to note that the Panthers didn't emerge in isolation, right? They were part of this larger movement of people who were talking about poverty and police brutality and, you know, the educational inequities and
the police brutality that includes shaking down black clubs here in Oakland to create $250,000 pigs. Now, maybe it's a third of a million by now, 2017, but 10 years ago, Oakland cop could make $250,000 by doing overtime at the black clubs due to falsely inflated crime statistics. So every time they lie about it, they get to force them to hire these security guards. That was the story that Chauncey Bailey was talking about. So Chauncey was a black editor of the Oakland Tribune until he was trying to say $250,000 pigs. And then Tom Orloff and Chief Tucker did not want to know or did not ask what "we smoked some coke on the way down to ambush him" meant, you know, so that they could let Antoine Mackey, the getaway driver, go after Magana said, well, sure, it came back with a ding mirror after Mackey borrowed it, you know, before 7:30 that morning. Now, they had sat on that warrant for 2 days because that shotgun that was stolen, when everybody in this town knew who would be smashing up the liquor store with bow ties on, you know. Everybody in this town knew when the OPD had to supposedly cut a deal with a laughing triple murderer. And then, you know, so I have no problem with a 25-year maximum sentence, you know. Let's make that standard no matter what you do, you know. It's 30 in Nicaragua, you know. So that the guy who had chopped the nurse's head off with the machete, the Contra, he was out in 3 years running at the nurse from the tracks. Or no, at the owner of the women's clinic there. And she invited him to lunch, okay, as the nurse from the tracks was escorting the Contra to the hospital so that he could say, "You can't kill her, she's the only one taking care of her family." But I digress, but that's the point.
Housing shortages and things like that. Oakland was a very dynamic place. It certainly had its finger on the pulse of what was happening around the country, especially in the Southern Civil Rights Movement. But it also had its own local manifestations of that, which kind of spoke to, I think, to how politics and what politics meant to the black communities of Oakland.
Why Bobby and Bobby Seale, and why Huey Newton? There's been a lot written, and you do some of that, obviously, in your text about their background, their meeting at Merritt College, and their kind of personalities and passions. But why, as you've done this over 20 years or so, why did they become the two people? What's special other than just being black activists in the 1960s is there to be gleaned about Huey and about Bobby?
Oh, great question. I mean, I think in a lot of ways they kind of, you know, they represented this kind of dualism. Bobby Seale was a consummate communicator, right? He was a stand-up comedian. You see this even today, like in 2017, Bobby Seale is universally, you know, loved by the rank-and-file members of the Black Panther Party. He had that human touch, and I think that initially when the Panthers began, they grew out of those human connections that people had. People sat and talked to each other. They tried to convince each other. It was face-to-face activism. It had a lot to do with debating and study groups and working together. All of those things kind of created a loyalty and a common experience. I think Bobby Seale represents that. Hugh Newton, on the other hand, is interesting because he, in a lot of ways, was the firebrand of the organization. He was very unafraid to confront. And I think that his ability to master that, I feel like some of the, you know, the greatest people that we see in African-American history, it's not that they weren't afraid, but they were able to overcome that and use that productively to kind of mount this resistance that inspired people. And I think that together, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale really inspired people. I think the 10-point platform and program that they came up with was a basic articulation of the bread and butter needs that people felt they had. It was not a big theoretical document. You know, it spoke about the today, the here and now, the vision for the future in practical language that people could relate to. And I think they also spoke to the times. Right. It's interesting to note that the Panthers didn't expand because Hugh Newton and Bobby Seale went around the country and spoke on campuses and in communities, and people rallied behind them and then started Panther chapters. They saw the Panthers on television and they said, we want to become members of the Black Panther Party. So you would have people who were either involved in activism and organizations beforehand who would change their organizational name into the Black Panther Party and, you know, meet the rules and requirements of being a member of the Black Panther Party as a chapter or a branch. And you have people who were never involved in activism before who were inspired by what they saw as the Panthers standing up, really in the legacy of Malcolm X. I think that at that particular moment in history, there was really the desire and need for a collective and organized response to what many people saw was this continuation of violence, harassment, inequality after almost a decade of civil rights activity in a fervored way. I mean, in 1955, that's where we have Emmett Till, Brown versus Board of Ed, Montgomery bus boycott is taking off in 55. Now it's 66. It's 11 years later, right? So the people who grew up watching that are no longer as convinced about what, you know, sort of the slow march of time and progress.
Mm-hmm. You do a good job with that. You really paint a great picture of this organization in Oakland that people all around the country are saying, hey, I want to be part of that. You almost get this image of people just streaming across the country, a bus or by foot or by plane or whatever, mm-hmm. to get to Oakland to somehow be part of this. You talk in there at some point, you have a chapter which is a section within a chapter which is talking about the, from a lead organization, I think, to a mass movement. And as I read through, I was looking for things that might be considered to be turning points. I'm wondering, those two events in the early period of the party, Denzel Dowell, of course, the case in Richmond, and the event in Sacramento. And how did that push the party from being something that you and Bobby were very clear about what they were doing in Oakland to a mass movement? And your assessment of how that, was the party ready for that? Was it something that you don't have to worry about being ready for? It happens. Your thoughts, Dr. Spencer?
That's a good question. I feel like in a lot of ways the Panthers were, I mean, it was a flood of people, of interest, and all of that. And you can see organizationally how they're responding to that. At first, it's an embrace of all of these new bodies, these new people, these new faces. And when it's local people that you know, or people that went to the same high school as other people, or people whose brother has, you know, knows that one's brother. There's that still same sense of familiarity, but as the organization grows, and as repression becomes an increasingly visible part of that growth, you see the Panthers trying to pursue other ways of managing the growth.
Many of you before, that the Occupy movement, and especially as it reached Oakland, because, you know, Oakland now has a reputation of being the most radical and progressive Occupy movement across the country. Maybe you don't know that, but people I talk to in New York and Georgia and other places absolutely respect what Occupy Oakland has done and the blood that you've already shed, what you have, you know. And I think that the importance of the Occupy movement cannot be lost, and we can't allow ourselves to fall back because of whatever is going on, and we don't have the kind of movement that we want. Now, I want to just say, just quickly, you know, when Dr. King, just before he was killed, talked about the question of where do we go from here, and that's the question I think we're facing right now. And one of the things that King said is that in order for us to know where we go from here, we have to talk about where we are now. And in that time, he spoke about black people, and I want to mention this because I wanted to show you the connections that are going on today. As I mentioned to many people, what the whole purpose of Dr. King, the activity that he was geared toward at the time of his assassination was the Poor People's Campaign, if you remember. And the Poor People's Campaign was to occupy, literally, the area around the White House and all throughout D.C., set up Tent City, which they did do, and say that we're not going until we get what's ours. Now, that was a powerful statement. Now, in addressing that question, Dr. King said, where do we go from here? Well, we look and we see black people. We see that we, despite the Civil Rights Act and all the legislation, we have half of what is good and double of what is bad. And that the White House and the government is going to have to change that condition. And so what we're going to Washington, D.C., at the time he said in 1968, 67, and then 68, what is ours is we want guaranteed income. We don't have jobs, so we want a guaranteed income, and we know the government can provide it, because the government is spending all the money in the world on war that has nothing to do with us, and we want that defense budget shifted so we can all, if we can't get a job, we want guaranteed income. But what we ultimately want, Dr. King said, and people don't remember this, we want a total redistribution of the wealth of this nation. If you remember, when he started talking about redistribution of wealth, Dr. King was mowed down like a dog in Memphis, Tennessee, and if anybody thinks James Earl Ray was the assassin, then I got some other stories to tell you about this government. Now, I say that today because at the same time, the Black Panther Party was talking about the liberation of black people. But what we recognize is that while we had a subjective goal in our own interest, that our goal could not be achieved, and we were not on moral or ethical ground if we talked about the liberation of black people in the context of the oppression of the native people. So we said we can't be free as long as the native people are oppressed, so we said we have to form, we formed a coalition with American Indian Movement, AIMS, Leonard Peltier, Free Leonard Peltier Today. We said, how are we going to talk about the freedom of black people in the context of the oppression of the Latinos that are working the farms of California like the slaves in Georgia? We said, we can't be free. So we helped to form and formed a coalition with the Brown Berets. But what about the Puerto Ricans and others working the fields and the industrial fields of New York and living in poverty? We said we can't talk in Chicago. So we helped to form the coalition with the Young Lords organization. And what about the Chinese and the Asians? We formed a coalition with the Red Guard. And what about half the world, women? We said, how can we talk about black liberation in the context of the oppression of women? And so we said that women's liberation was a part of our agenda. And what about gays? We were the only black organization, matter of fact, the only progressive organization that saw the question of gay liberation as a part of the revolutionary struggle that we were engaged in. We said, what about the people who are disabled? And we formed a coalition with the Center for Independent Living. And what about the messed up environment in this country and how we're all subject to the horrors of that environment? So we formed a coalition with the Center for with the Trust for Public Land and created a program of Gardens in the Ghetto. And what about our brothers and sisters that were in Vietnam fighting against the American, the same oppressor that we had? We didn't call for peace in Vietnam. We called for victory for the Viet Cong. We said, what about our brothers and sisters that were fighting against the same imperial empire in South Africa? We said we formed a coalition with the PAC. And we said, what about in Zimbabwe? We formed a coalition with ZANU. And what about in Mozambique? We formed a coalition with Frelimo. Now, I say all that to say that one of the things that the Occupy movement has inspired me is that it has reached beyond the question of one group versus another.
We don't have any conflict. We know who the common enemy is. And that enemy you have identified in language that everyone around the world now identifies with, and that's the 1%.
Yeah.
Understand one thing, that the rest of us are the 99%. So the question is, what are we going to do and where do we go from here? And I want to remind you of something that made you who you are and us who we are as I joined in and gave my voice to what you already started in Oakland. Glad to walk the clothes down the port of Oakland. Tell me they lost $4 to $8 million that day. I was like, oh, you had $8 million? That's it, that's $8 million right now. We won't close nothing down if we start having some profit sharing and some redistribution of wealth around here. But yes, let's shut it down every day that we're not getting a dime out of that. 5 schools closing only need $2 million to reopen and $8 million a day. Give me a break. So what has the Occupy movement done? It's done what we used to say was quoting one of the great revolutionary minds and leaders of this world, Che Guevara. We would always say, words are beautiful. You know, everybody wants to rap around here lately. I get tired of rapping. But anyway, everybody got a rap or some kind of piece. Words are beautiful, but actions are supreme. What makes Occupy distinct from every other thing that's been here since the days of the Black Panther Party is you have put words into action. And you have created an environment for change and for the kind of change that some people thought Obama was bringing, which is a sad story that you didn't get that bill. But anyway, you're here now, we're here now, and what I want to say is that actions aren't supreme. And when we come together to develop an agenda, or where do we go from here, let's remember that what makes you distinguished from everyone else is that you took action. If we didn't all agree on every single thing, we agreed about one thing. We knew we were a part of the oppressed group and we were united against our oppressors, the 1%, the capitalists. This cannot be a capitalist movement. We can't tolerate that. We already know this is anti-capitalist because there's no way that you're going to have this kind of continuum of exploitation and talk about real change in the world. We may not agree on every ideology. There are people talk about nonviolence versus violence as though this is a serious question when it's not a serious question. And the reason it's not serious because, first of all, when we talk about guns and picking up guns as we did in the Black Panther Party, we said a gun is not necessarily revolutionary because the pigs have guns. The pigs meaning the state, the police, the government of the United States, and all that it represents, which is the corporations and so forth. They have more guns than we can even imagine having. So violence is already here. The NRA alone is perpetrating more violence than the average person. So we don't have the question of violence and nonviolence. We have a question of, do we want to take some actions, and do we want to make them meaningful? When people, and I think it was, what was it, 28th of, was it January? 28th of January, and I was out here in the streets, and I saw people took over a building, and I only felt that maybe strategically there were a few mistakes made, and maybe we could have held the line better. We could talk about strategies. But I love taking over that building. That used to be the Oakland Auditorium, and we used to have a whole lot of things going on in Oakland Auditorium. The bottom line is this. People said, oh, look, the occupied people are violent. This in the face of talking about bringing every troop in the world down on people just because of the nonviolent protest against the Port of Oakland and its wealth and house and its exploitation. I watched a young girl on a bicycle get mowed down by the police. Yep. And I watched a black cop and a woman cop, and I asked both of them, I said, how the hell do you stand up here when we done fought for you, for women's liberation and black liberation, and this is what you did with it? I said, you're not my brother, you're not my sister. So we have to be clear about what we're doing, not be afraid or ashamed to say, oh, well, we're not violent, we have to explain our, we don't have anything to explain. We're doing the right thing. So all I want to say to you now in closing is that I'm a part of you, and you, I feel a part of this movement. I know I talk to different people around the country who've been in the movement many years, and some of us who are tired of being alive and thought it was all over, but the shouting, and then came the shouting, and then came Occupy, and it gave us and reinvigorated us. I didn't have any problem. I'll be 70 in March. I walked like I was 12 years old walking around there to close that damn port. So bottom line is this. You guys are leaders. You can bring other people into this, but the way we're going to do that is you're going to have to take some actions again. That doesn't mean we get killed. It doesn't mean we get beat up. We have to find some better actions and some more strategic actions. But the bottom line is that's who you have become. You've got your, the world is recognizing you. The world is recognized Occupy Oakland specifically. So we'll be proud.
Global.
Let's say, let's join together. Let's keep this going. And let's remember the power belongs to the people. All power to the people. Straight turns round.
work. I'm really happy that you came away with that impression.
I did, and it's not, I think probably many others have. I don't know that we've sat down and taken the time to think about how deeply it drilled in the family. I think what sparked it, Dr. Spencer, in my thoughts of the conversation with you today, is that when you get to the part there and you're talking about the end of the party, the demise of the party in the late 70s, you have at times less than 100 people who are, for lack of a better word, broken.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning who are being asked to contribute money to their schools, who are being asked to take a percentage of their check like a tithe, who haven't been able to see their children. And they were soldiers, no doubt, because they were still there. But it appears to be just very, it's very painful. Was it painful for you as you got to this, as you walked these years of the party?
It was. I mean, it really, really was. I thought many times of the times I would have left the organization. I thought about, especially those familial connections, people's, you know, just their request to spend more individual time with their children. I thought about the sacrifice of the giving up your autonomy. I think that today political activism can mean sending some emails, clicking some, you know, petitions, the stuff that you publicize online, going down to a meeting. But how many of us belonging to a political organization means that someone else is telling us what to do from morning to night, day after day after day? And that is what it meant to be part of the Black Panther Party. And the way in which people made that sacrifice, I think out of the commitment that they had to the people they were serving, out of the commitment they had to each other, maybe partially due to the fact that they were and had given up their families oftentimes to be part of this, to be part of this organization, mm-hmm. you know, was very, very real. And I think I saw those, like, familial dynamics, even just with how Huey Newton was treated. I mean, to me, it was like watching this beloved figure who everyone knows is declining in so many different ways, but nobody wants to, you know, confront or is unable to kind of separate themselves. So that was one thing I always asked myself, like, why is it that rather than people drifting away from the organization, why didn't they have a change of leadership? Why didn't they figure out another way of going forward to keep those people going? Why weren't they able to transform themselves into some other type of formation that would have allowed them to continue on? You know, why did everyone leave, just leaving behind, you know, the leadership at the very end?
Yeah, there. Sometimes you hear people use the word post-traumatic stress syndrome. As I read through it, I think the word that came to my mind when you look at the broader definition of genocide, that it, in some senses, it seems as if the COINTEL program, maybe not in terms of its individual pieces, but in terms of its goal, was to wipe to end the existence of this, not just of the party, but of this militancy. Is genocide going too far, Robin?
Well, you know, now that we know, I mean, even now today in 2016, it came out, like, you know, just the role of drugs, right? And how, you know, from the highest level of the government, drugs were seen as a way of, you know, squashing this urban rebellion.
And coming from the Bay, Ishi Bay, we have the 1983 Frogman case where Joseph Russinello gave them their 30-some thousand of coke profits because they said, we're Contras. No. Here's some more about that. This Contra war is going on against Iraq, Syria, Libya, Afghanistan, all those countries on the post-9/11 hit list, and it's the same people we used to bring down the USSR, funded by the Afghan opium war, Poppy Bush's gang, the Clintons, you know, the $20 million from one Saudi prince to the Clinton Foundation, the Podesta emails saying, oh yeah, the Saudis are funding these axe murdering child rapists, the Salafist Principality, Michael Flynn's 2012 DIA report describes the West as backing to take apart Syria, okay? the countries, the socialists on the 9/11 hit list. That 9/11 Northwood op was the PNAC Pentagon having a day off so that their drones could make this mind control mind fork happen, where Americans believe no steel frame structure in history has fallen except on 9/11/01. And just 10 points down the dial, the author who was saying, oh, firemen should stop running into buildings now. And the cardboard cutout when I said, you know, no steel frame structure in history has ever fallen from fire. Well, then there was Reese. That's a civil war in the death squad region. You're paying to murder the government to blow up their military brass. Oh, take it from here, Sean Stone.
Well, the one of the biggest ones was Abdullah Aziz, Osama bin Laden's brother. Also, you had a group of Saudis and Kuwaitis and Qataris who had Swiss bank accounts, all of which were being funneled through groups like the Optimus Foundation, which was a UBS internal organization. And a lot of sub-level money laundering mechanisms that process this money into just a long sort of river. It's sort of like if you look at it like the top of a mountain and all that snow comes down into a thousand little creeks and rivers. That's where you had Swiss banks, UBS, as the top of the mountain, and it had all sorts of little levees and docks and internal organizations that financed and filtered all this money that got down into Kuwait, Qatar, Yemen, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, besides the Iranian banks and things like that. So you had a lot of just Swiss bank accounts. You also had a lot of CIA bank accounts in UBS that had been, the combinations had been changed. So a lot of CIA money that had been in there had been changed and stolen from, there's two schools in the CIA. You have the domestic CIA and then you have the international CIA, and they don't talk to each other. So one Paul steals money from Peter, if you will. And you had a lot of money there. And a lot of that will be exposed in the court documents and filings that will involve Dov Zakheim and others. They'll be brought in as material witnesses because the case against me, the criminal case, is still pending. And all of these people and activities I'm going to bring in as material witnesses and subpoena to testify that what they did to me was to cover up all this stuff that I found out later. And I anticipate when all of that material is demanded, every email, every letter, every phone call, that matrix is going to yield proof that Dov Zakheim is intimately connected with the Saudi financing of ISIS and ISIL through UBS Swiss banks, and Brad Birkenfeld and Snowden and Assange will testify to the materials that are relevant to that. And to a certain degree, they will be exonerated because the American public would see that as, you know, guys trying to do the patriotic thing. Brad tried to do the patriotic thing. I tried to do the patriotic thing. Snowden tried to do the patriotic thing. He did a little bit differently. I mean, he took material and shot it up, a lot of which we haven't seen because they haven't released it, a lot of which is directly connected to Birkenfeld's material. That's what they're very hesitant or scared of. I don't think Greenwald's got the guts to release that because he's afraid he's going to get killed.
So that's the same subject that Abby Martin and Lee Camp were talking about right here. Hey, Lee. I don't think you're on. Oh, click. Thank you. Triangle, could you change into a pause signal? I'll hit you again, and then I'll just probably make it a 1 second thing because it started and stopped and little things going around, and well, I could hit the pause on Audacity, but God knows how long that would take, and then it would start, and then let's go to the theme song because mm-hmm.
to see. You can do it if you try. Any puppy, dog, or pussy. Do the jerk, do the fly. You can do woolly bully. What can you pull a woolly bully? Can you
wag the dog? And the woolly bully in this case is Trump, and you wag him by saying you're connected to Russia, you're in bed with Putin, like the previous wag the dog to get Yugoslavia bombed was you're in bed with Monica. Well, don't know if they ever made it that far, but it doesn't matter because that's all a distraction from Mina, the Poppy Bush, opium, Afghan war, coke stand attendants, the Clinton Foundation getting millions by the tens of millions from the royal...
Most of these provocations, these terror events like we saw in London, you know, they, it appears that it's the radical Muslims that are taking credit through site intelligence group and so on. But if you check to see who's really behind it, it turns out to be kind of the opposite of what the original headlines would have suggested. And that's also true, as we see in our next slide, of the anti-Semitic threats that have been sweeping the country. Back one slide. Don't we go back one slide there?
Interesting connection.
Yeah, so yeah, this is Josh. It's like a new Joshua Goldberg, your old friend.
Yes. No, this is a huge story, and
if I can read it, it says an 18-year-old U.S. Israeli citizen is allegedly behind most of the Jewish community bomb threats. It says Peter Jacobs. An 18-year-old man has been arrested in Israel over a series of bomb threats made to Jewish community centers worldwide over a six-month period, according to the Jerusalem Post. U.S.-Israeli citizen, the suspect is reportedly responsible for bombing other threats across the U.S. as well as in Europe, Australia, and New Zealand. He is a Jewish-Israeli, Associated Press reports. A police officer blocks an entrance as officials respond to a bomb threat at the Jewish Community Center in Louisville, Kentucky, U.S., March 8, 2017. Sources indicate that most of the blah, blah, blah. So,
and it should be stopped. We should stop and look at this very carefully, go into the background, just as that agent who was filmed by Al Jazeera TV, paying off and negotiating to turn politicians on behalf of Israel. This story that it's a Jewish young person, supposedly troubled young person based in Israel, responsible for multiple bombings or threats of bombings of Jewish cultural centers, attacks on synagogues, Jewish funeral installations of various sorts, cemeteries and such, that this all goes back to some kind of motivated Israeli citizen seeking to do the work of Yahweh or Zionist agenda. This is hugely important. Of course, in the next story, you know, this occurs just as Amazon.com does this book burning. Apparent rise of anti-Semitism, this media line, this meme that anti-Semitism is on the rise and unleashed and becoming increasingly menacing, and therefore Amazon.com must burn books, must take out information that might feed this rising anti-Semitism. This meme is very powerful, is very influential. It's, you know, instructing our legislatures, our parliaments, our Congress. And so this particular story, needs a lot of scrutiny, needs a lot of highlighting. I wonder if, you know, this story isn't a limited hangout of some sort, that this, supposedly troubled Israeli teenager who's doing all these things is not some kind of offered up front because it's way worse and way more monumental, and this is sort of a limited hangout offering to divert us from a story which is deeper and bigger.
Of course, Joshua Goldberg, the man who was behind that horrific genocidal kill all Jews image that was planted on your Facebook page as the main public relations stunt to try to get you fired at the University of Lethbridge.
We'll get back to that, but let me finish up with Scott and Sean Stone here on the Lip TV.
But it's all going to come out.
So, you know, obviously people hear the Saudis financing terrorism, and they're not yet getting the connection. There's something missing here. Remember, we have the 28 pages missing from the 9/11 Commission report. People like Bob Graham are saying, divulge those pages. You know, there are literally congressmen like Walter Jones saying there's treasonous material here, because not only are we talking about the Saudis, again, we're talking about a Saudi family that was very close, as we know, to the Bush family, for example, and many of these neocons like Dov Zakheim. So, you know, is this what you've basically come to understand, is that it's not just Saudis financing, but it literally does tie back to these people like your former boss, Dov Zakheim, who are protecting them?
Well, it's the Saudis, it's the Kuwaitis, it's the Qataris, it's the royal families in all of those countries. And the highest levels of the government officials are the royal families. I mean,
Wag, can you wag the dog?
Was undoubtedly a Sayanim. You know, the Mossad is the envy of all of the world's intelligence agencies, because they can mobilize tens, if not hundreds of thousands of sleeper agents, basically, which are Jewish people who are loyal to Israel and who will work for free for the Israeli Mossad. And it'll be utterly deniable. And so they can get everybody from Larry Silverstein to help them blow up the World Trade Center to Joshua Goldberg to help them try to get Tony Hall fired. And when somebody like this over in Israel turns out to be behind most of the threats against Jewish community centers in the United States, it's obvious that we're talking about an organized operation, not some kind of lone nut teenager. So I think you're absolutely on the right track by calling this a limited hangout.
It was Victor Ostrowski, a Canadian Mossad agent, who released this word, who introduced us to this concept of Sayanim. And, it's a hugely important concept of people who are living their life in day-to-day ways. Mossad needs, some kind of falsified certificate or some kind of a leasing operation. They need something that can be provided, and those suddenly a Sayanim, a Jewish person who believes in the Israeli cause and future and destiny, is sort of recruited for a specific job. And as you say, this is an enormously important resource for Zionist agendas, and it's definitely used and manipulated. Is that what you think is going on here, Kevin?
Absolutely. This whole supposed rise in anti-Semitism is basically a hoax. All of these threats, it turns out, came either from this guy in Israel, who was responsible for most of them, or from that former writer.
Said to be responsible for most of them.
Yeah, right. He's taking the blame, but it came from Israel, and he's the guy who's taking the blame. The others, came from that former journalist at The Blaze, or wherever he was, at Greenwald's outfit, who apparently was basically a Jew in everything but name, who was surrounded by Jews for his whole life. And then the story is that he was dumped by his Jewish girlfriend, and so he delivered a few of these threats too. That's hardly an anti-Semite in the classical sense. And then finally the cemeteries, it turns out there were no cemetery desecrations at all. It was all just old cemeteries that the forces of the second law of thermodynamics had been knocking over headstones. So the whole thing was a giant hoax, but now we have hundreds and hundreds of books burned at Amazon, and I wonder if Jeff Bezos is going to unburn those books. Somehow I doubt it.
But we can't have knowledgeable, evidence-based discussions on the real things in our society that are going on, and the fear of being tagged with these terms, with these three weaponized terms. This has really undermined the effectiveness of our universities. People who want tenure, who want professional jobs, in public commentary, they know to be tagged with any of those terms as a career destroyer.
If any of our viewers, haven't yet looked into this Holocaust issue, it's obvious that they don't want you to. And, you know, who knows what you'll really find if you do look into it. But because these forces of censorship clearly don't want you to read any of these books, you really should protest by at least reading one.
A vast beach filled with sand. And if you move one piece of sand to, you know, from one place in the beach to another part of the beach, does that make you a Holocaust denier? Of what really happened on 9/11. Anything that keeps that discussion going, I suppose we have to hold our nose and accept that it serves some purpose.
Okay, and of course Saudi Arabia is pushing back, as we see in the next slide in the Newsweek story, which mentions that Trump was in favor of this JASTA bill, allowing these victims to sue Saudi Arabia, basically raped people and so on and so forth. And they should also be standing up against the torture that elicited the false confessions that has allowed the authorities to blame innocent people.
Oh, yeah. So there are two prongs of the Big Brother mind fork security state, and torture and assassination go hand in hand because, of course, you don't want to capture and find out intelligence from anybody that's a bad guy. No. Because if there's a bad guy, it's us, okay? You can't really talk about, intelligent failures and deep states when we were founded the year after the UK abolished slave trade to evade that common law. And so there you have a century of slavery. In no case could a white citizen be convicted on the testimony of an Indian, the California Indian Indentured Act of 1850. And of course, the Second Amendment saying the security of a slaveholder state being requiring you to have 2 6-guns. So forget everything else we just said in the First Amendment. You know, we're a slaveholding state. We call this a free state, and we call this a free country, and we call this democracy because we declared everybody here the enemy. 99% we've exterminated virtually. 98%, okay, because it went from 15 million to 150,000, you know, like a century, a little more over a century ago, and then it's climbing slowly back. So, if you weren't westernized, you're part of the genocide. If you weren't westernized, you're the 1%, you know, that survived the 99% that are.
This New York Times article this week told us about, you know, some more details about this torture, which, you know, they pry, you know, they yank people's knee joints apart and basically raped people and so on and so forth. It's pretty horrible, especially considering that this is how they got these false confessions. But as we see in the next slide, Guantanamo judge has just ordered testimony by the people responsible for destroying the videotapes of this torture, and covering up the evidence of how they elicited their false confessions. So that could get interesting.
But
yeah, the New York Times, of course, is on side with the torture too.
All the rage downtown.
But with Trump's comments about, oh yeah, Jeffrey Epstein, he sure loves those young youngsters. I don't think Trump is going to be going too far off the range. And of course, he's appointed all these right wingers to head the State Department. Well, there was the Exxon guy, so nothing's going to happen on the oil front. Oil depletion allowance, along with the Vietnam withdrawal orders, the executive order 11110, and stopping nukes in Israel that got JFK's brains blown out. Old drone bomber reminded us is going to just keep all presidents in the military's war path. So, I always try to chop my show down to an hour and 20 minutes so I can listen to it on a CD someday. Bye. See me next Tuesday at noon, 104.1 FM, BerkeleyLiberationRadio.info. And we're on Streama and TuneIn Radio. So /PLR or something like that.
Can you wag? Can you wag?